Bienvenidos and welcome to the Jackerman Sports Show, episode number 92. I am your host, Matthew Miranda, calling out episode numbers again because we're getting close to 100 and we like big round numbers as people. So I'm excited that we're getting close to 100. In honor of 92 episodes, there are two athletes who come to mind when I think of the number 92. One from the world of professional hockey, former one-time, one-year New York Ranger, Michael Nylander. Not really a special player for any special reason. It was not a good time in Rangers history, and Nylander was not exactly like a superstar. But I was drawn to the NHL as a child for the wordplay, for the names, for all the different things that the different sounds, the different letters, the different rules and patterns and just and names that you would be exposed to. I loved as a kid hearing the Russian names. I always remember, you know, Konstantinov, Nemchinov, all those. I loved it. So I really loved alliteration, and you would get names like Kelly Kissio and Mikko Makkola and Mark Messier and Jaromir Jagr. Like, hockey was a very musical language. It still is, I think. And Michael Nylander hit me especially oddly hard because around the time Nylander came to the Rangers, I had recently moved briefly to North Carolina, which was the first time I had left the friendly confines of New York State to live in another state, and very quickly discovered that it's one thing to visit North Carolina, but it's another thing entirely to live there. I'm sure a lot of people are happy there. I was not. I came back to New York, and so was always struck by the sight of this player on my hockey team whose jersey literally said New York Land. So there's my stupid Michael Nylander story. The other 92 who always comes to mind is Reggie White, former defensive lineman for the Philadelphia Eagles and then the Green Bay Packers. If you are not familiar with Reggie White, beyond his football prowess, and he was, you know, arguably some people say the greatest defensive player they've seen. I got to put Lawrence Taylor ahead of that, but Reggie White is up there. But I don't remember Reggie White for his awesome run-stuffing abilities or his ability to sack quarterbacks with extreme prejudice. I remember Reggie White's other prejudice. If you Google Reggie White's speech, you will find it as well. Reggie White, in the 90s, at some point gave a speech before the Wisconsin, I believe, House of Representatives. It was some government body. And Reggie White gave a mortifying speech that basically highlighted his ability to offer the simplest, most offensive caricatures of just about every racial group in the United States. So, Hall of Fame career, that's not why I remember Reggie White. I remember that speech. This episode, so there's a guest that you will hear in a couple minutes. That segment has already been recorded, but I'm going to do a couple little stories just before the guest and also give you some background on a story that came up with our guest, but when it came up in the interview, we didn't get really much of a chance to offer some clarification and depth on it, so I want to do that here. So first, I will tell you the two non-guest stories, and then we'll get to that part. First, I want to offer a Jackerman Sports Show first, a huzzah. I don't think I've ever offered a huzzah to anyone, but I'm offering one to someone by the name of Kelvin Kiptum. Again, we can't get away from alliterative names today. Kelvin Kiptum, you may never have heard of this person. I never heard of them until about 2 or 3 days ago. Kelvin Kiptum is a marathon runner, 23 years old, and just ran a world record. Kelvin Kiptum is a Kenyan long-distance runner, 23 years old, just set the record by running an entire 26.2-mile marathon in 2 hours and 35 seconds. So if that sounds fast, it is. Here's how fast it was, first of all. Kiptum beat the old record by 34 seconds, which is kind of astonishing. If you think of, like, particularly in sports like track and field and cross country, you don't see people win and then have to wait a half a minute for second place all the time. And to beat the world record by 34 seconds is just remarkable. But on top of that, one thing I like about Kiptum's record is that it's one of, like, a lot of times you talk about sports records, it's kind of like when you talk about distance and size in outer space, where the scale is so obscenely beyond what any of us are used to that it just doesn't make sense. Like, when you talk about there's a black hole somewhere that can fit 10 billion suns in it, that's a quirky fact, but, like, who can wrap their mind around that? Like, you ever driven through Nebraska? Nebraska is 8 hours long and it smells like shit the whole time because often there's like manure on the fields. My memory of going cross country is hitting Nebraska and spending 8 hours holding my nose because, I mean, I was a kid and because it smelled like feces the whole time. That's just Nebraska, which is a small, a medium-sized state in one country on our relatively small planet. You think of how much larger, how many Earths fit into Jupiter, how many Jupiters fit into our sun, how many of our suns fit into larger suns, and then you're supposed to fit 10 billion of those into, like, there's no sense of scale there. And I feel like in sports, a lot of that happens as well. When you talk about, oh, this person hit 100 mile an hour fastball 500 feet, there's no personal physical conception of what that means. Like, you don't know what it's like to hit 100 mile an hour pitch or to hit anything 500 feet. I don't know. I've dunked on adjustable rims when I was a child. I have no idea what it's like to go up for a slam dunk and throw down on a 7-footer. I don't know what it's like to hit a slap shot from, you know, 40 feet away that goes in. I don't know what it's like to get hip checked. I don't know what it's like to nutmeg somebody. Like, I don't, there's so many things in sports you cannot fathom. But what's fun about Kiptum's record is that you can put it into terms, I think, that can at least give us a reasonable sense of scale and appreciation for what was done. So first of all, he did the marathon basically in 2 hours. So imagine you're on a treadmill at the gym and you set it to 13. I asked on Twitter a few people, I asked a question this week, like, how long do you think you could last on a treadmill set at 13? When I was in my physical glory in my mid-20s, I would say that I was proud on a treadmill if I could do like 8, 8.5 speed for like 2 minutes. And then you'd have to slow down and catch your heart rate and whatever. 8.5 is fast on a treadmill. 13 is extremely fast. He did it for 2 hours. He did it for 2 hours nonstop. A lot of us can't walk 2 hours without stopping. He ran 13 miles an hour for 2 hours. That is astonishing, and it's also fathomable. So for those two reasons, Kelvin Kiptum, you get the Jackerman Sports Show huzzah today. The other story I want to touch on a little, because I don't think I got into it last episode when we had Warren Light on, was the NBA season is going to drop in a couple of weeks. The WNBA season is in the finals, and that's who today's guest is. If you stay on just a couple of minutes longer in the episode, I'm going to talk to Lindsay D'Arcangelo of The Athletic. Lindsay's been on the show before a few times, and we're going to talk about the finals and some WNBA issues. But the big story in the NBA recently were the sequence of trades that led to Damian Lillard ending up in Milwaukee and then Drew Holiday being routed from Portland to Boston in the fallout of the Lillard deal. And I don't love this trade for the Celtics. I may try to get Jonah Virch on again before the season starts to talk about the Celtics. But I don't like this for them, and this is why. The Celtics are at a point where there's nothing left for them to do but win a title. They were in the finals a couple of years ago. They lost in six. They've made like four of the last five or five of the last six Eastern Conference finals. Like, the Celtics have done every single thing that there is to do. This group of Celtics has done everything there is to do other than win a championship. And they've had really great depth over the last couple of years. They have obvious, you know, a tremendous offensive fulcrum in Jason Tatum, a wonderful secondary star in Jaylen Brown. They had Marcus Smart as a point guard and defensive player of the year. Robert Williams and Al Horford combined gave them a really defensively strong pairing of bigs. They had a really, really deep backcourt after Smart with Malcolm Brogdon, who was Sixth Man of the Year, and Derek White, and someone I'm thinking of, Smart, Brogdon, White. I mean, that's just deep. That's a deep, deep team, and they've shown it. They've had tremendous regular seasons. They've had great regular season success. They've beaten other teams who are, at least in the East, considered top of the line. They've beaten Milwaukee. They've beaten Philadelphia. Brooklyn, when Brooklyn wasn't really Brooklyn anymore. But the Celtics have nothing to do other than win a title. So on that level, it makes sense that they would make the moves that they made this offseason. They have basically sacrificed four players for two. The Celtics have let two front court players go and two back court players. They let Robert Williams go in the trade to Portland, and also Malcolm Brogdon. And also this offseason, they traded Marcus Smart in the deal to pick up Kristaps Porzingis. And they also let Grant Williams go as a free agent to Dallas. So they let Robert and Grant Williams go from their front court and replaced them with Porzingis. They've let Malcolm Brogdon and Marcus Smart go from their back court and brought in Jrue Holiday. Now, in a vacuum, these are the kinds of moves that a title contender makes, because Porzingis, as one player, is a better overall player than the two that he's coming in and replacing. He's better overall than Grant Williams. Grant Williams is a... he'd start for some teams and come off the bench for a lot. Robert Williams is a defensively excellent big man who on offense is pretty much like a rim runner. Kristaps Porzingis can do more things than that. Like, if you literally just make a laundry list of the things that he can do more of them. And you see that reflected in his resume and in his salary. Jrue Holiday, very similar. As great as Marcus Smart is, one-time defensive player of the year, pretty much universally regarded as the heartbeat of the Celtics. And Malcolm Brogdon just last year was sixth man of the year with the Boston Celtics. But again, compared to Jrue Holiday, a multi-time All-Star, also a defensive player of the year, a vastly superior shooter to Smart, just a better player than the other two. So again, in a vacuum, you have to like that move because they are better at point guard than they were a month ago. But the thing is, seasons don't take places in vacuums. You notice a lot of times if you watch sports from home, one thing, or even if you're at the arena, but one thing that's very easy to forget sometimes is that human beings with cardio limits are doing these, they're playing these games. And exhaustion is a part of performance. And exhaustion multiplied over many, many months because of a lack of depth also impacts performance. So if you look at the Celtics now, the Celtics did this so they can be a title contender. So first, the Celtics now have a shorter rotation than they used to. Their three big men are Kristaps Porzingis, Al Horford, and Luke Kornet. If you look at those players' histories, you know, it's like going to the car lot and there's like a really hot car. But anyone who's ever rented it has told you, like, nah, it's going to break down. It always breaks down. There is something wrong inside the car, no matter how it looks, no matter what you think it can be, it always breaks down. Kristaps Porzingis, in his NBA career, going back to his first season as a Knick as a 20-year-old, he missed 10 games. The next year, he missed 16 games. The next year, he missed 34 games. The next year, he missed all 82 games, recovering from a torn ACL. The next year, he missed, I believe, let me check on this because this is COVID numbers now and they get weird. In 2020, which was his first year in Dallas, he missed 18 games. The following season, second year in Dallas, he missed about 30 games. The following season, 2 years ago, he missed 31 games. Last year, he missed 17. And Porzingis is now 27. So he has missed probably most of the games he could play in his career from age 20 to 27. It seems very unlikely that Kristaps Porzingis is going to miss fewer games as he gets older and as more and more of these injuries catch up to him. It just doesn't seem like that's a practical thing to hope for. Like, oh, maybe he'll be more durable. Probably not. Your second most talented center on the Celtics is Al Horford. Al Horford is 36 years old. Oh, I'm sorry. Al Horford is 37 years old. Your best big man never misses less than 20, 30 games a year. Your second best big man just would be putting it mildly. In June, Horford turned 37. Their third big man, and I have to be very careful how I phrase this because I like this player very much. Luke Kornet is also a 7-footer. He's 7'2". And he played last year a career high 69 games with the Celtics. But he is their third starter. He's their third big man. Now, Luke Kornet, I just want to shout out Luke Kornet's mother. Because when Luke Kornet used to play for the Knicks, and anytime we would write about him, or I would write about him in a recap, Luke Kornet's mother was a very sweet and regular reader. And anytime you put something nice about her son, she would often have nice things to say. So I do not come to tear apart Luke Kornet. If Mrs. Kornet, you happen to be listening to this show, I'm not coming for your boy. But your boy himself would acknowledge that he should not be the third best big man on a team that calls itself a title contender. So you've given up all this depth. How are you going to get through 82 games with those three players? I know the league has gone smaller, and it's not the big physical crucible that it used to be back in the 80s, the 90s, but it's still the physically demanding game that takes like half a year just to get to the playoffs. And you're going to the playoffs with Glass Joe, Methuselah, and a nice guy who's Frank Grimes, if you know The Simpsons, a nice guy who just no. That's the Celtics after these trades. So I'm not sure that they're in a better position than they were before they made the trades. Milwaukee, I think the Bucks are in a better position. Because I think the biggest problem the Bucks have had in recent years in the playoffs, like they take a hit. When you replace Drew Holiday with anybody at point guard, you're going to regress. Because he struggled very much last year, specifically in the Miami series against Jimmy Butler. But as a general rule, NBA players, not just guards, larger players. Kevin Durant has said, like the hardest player for him to go against, to be guarded by, is Drew Holiday. So anytime you lose Holiday, the defense will suffer somewhat. And that's not insignificant with the Bucks because the Bucks are a much older team. Their starting lineup is pretty much old from top to bottom. Brooke Lopez has got to be around 36. Giannis Antetokounmpo is now on the other side of 30. Chris Middleton, who's battled injuries the last couple of years, hasn't looked fully like himself in a while. He's around 32, 33. And they just traded Holiday for Lillard, who, and I believe Lillard is actually a little older even than Holiday. So it looks, again, fantastic. Like, but I think in the Bucks' case, there's a little more reason to be helpful. And I think it shows a direct contrast between them and the Celtics. The Celtics made a trade that I don't know when it's supposed to help them, but the lack of depth is not going to help them over the regular season, over 6 months and 82 games. Which I imagine is going to hurt their seeding because they're not going to be able to win so many to get to the playoffs as a high seed, which is going to make their matchups harder. I don't know how this makes the Celtics regular season better. And I don't, it does make them a more dangerous playoff team if and only if all these players are healthy and ready to go. And I don't see how you can count on that when you have less depth and now the people you're counting on are older and injury prone. With the Bucks, even though they're also extremely old and they face that same dilemma. But one thing that I like for Milwaukee about this trade is that even though it weakens their defense, what's really hurt the Bucks the last few playoffs as they get up into higher and higher levels of competition has been offensively, they haven't had the juice that they've needed against other teams. As Giannis Antetokounmpo is an amazing, amazing, amazing player, but he's a little unorthodox or as great as he is and as impactful as he is on offense, he's a bit unorthodox because he's such not a great shooter. He's not even a good shooter. He's just so physically imposing. He's basically like thinner Shaq with a better dribble. Obviously, he's a better shooter than that. But like, he's not a shooter. So despite the fact that the Bucks have this annual MVP caliber player on their team, you can run into trouble in the playoffs if your offense is centered around Giannis. Because Giannis, you can defend him a little differently. If you remember LeBron, especially before he started winning titles, if you remember LeBron, especially in the 2011 finals when the Heat played Dallas, even before that, when they used to play the Celtics also, teams at the time, as amazing a physical force as LeBron James was, he was a little easier to guard because, okay, he's not a great shooter. So we can put a wall in front of him, instruct the defense, like, whatever you do, whenever you can, put a wall in front of this man and force him to pull up and shoot. And you could have some success with that. You can have that success with Giannis. That's going to be much harder to do now that you have in Damian Lillard, a player that literally defenses have to honor up to 35 feet from the basket. Like, literally is, along with Steph Curry, probably the best deep, deep shooter in the league. And now you've put him with Giannis. So I think at least in the Bucks' case, they have the same questions that the Celtics do as far as age. They have the same questions, I think, as far as depth, especially after they made this trade. They had to get rid of a couple. They got rid of Grayson Allen. We'll see about what they have going forward. But at least I feel like the Bucks addressed something that's been a problem for them the last couple of postseasons. I don't know if the Celtics got enough for what they gave up, but we'll see. The last note I just wanted to give to you before the interview with Lindsay DeArcangelo rolls is to clarify the last story that she and I got into has to do with De'Erica Hamby, who is a WNBA player. She's a two-time All-Star, two-time Sixth Woman of the Year. She played many years for the Las Vegas Aces, who are currently in the finals. Hamby at the moment plays for the LA Sparks. She has filed a discrimination lawsuit against the Aces and the WNBA. There's already been punishment and fallout from this story. And this is what I asked Lindsay about at the end of the interview, and I want to make sure that I give you background on it now here so you'll understand a bit more. We don't talk about it a lot, but we didn't get into the background, and I want to make sure you have that. So Hamby's claim is that when she was negotiating for a deal with the Aces, that the Aces falsely accused her of signing a two-year deal in the summer of 2022 while she was knowingly pregnant. There's a lot here, so let me just give you all the background, and then the Lindsay interview, I think, will take care of it. We'll make sure that you understand the rest of it. Las Vegas's head coach, Becky Hammond, was suspended earlier this year for two games for violating what is called the league's respect in the workplace policies. Also, the Aces as a team had their 2025 first round pick taken away, apparently over promises of impermissible benefits that they made while negotiating with Hamby about her contract. Hamby's contract goes beyond just those complaints, though. Hamby claims in her lawsuit that she signed her extension on June 28th, 2022. And then discovered 3 weeks later in July that she was pregnant. She says that she disclosed that fact to the Aces and to Becky Hammond 2 weeks after she learned of it. Hamby's contention after this is that she says that the Aces, quote, began to retaliate against me and caused the work environment to become unreasonably abusive and hostile. She says that the Aces accused her of signing her contract extension while she was knowingly pregnant. That she didn't keep up with her workouts, that she wasn't committed to the team. Hamby says that Becky Hammond, the coach, told her she doubted Hamby would be ready to play in 2023 and was not holding up her end of the bargain. According to Hamby, quote, on January 17th, 2023, I received a call from Hammond during which she told me that my, quote, time with the Aces is up, end quote, and I was being traded and that it was best for my career. She told me, quote, I can send you somewhere like Connecticut or Indiana, or you can pick a place like Los Angeles, end quote. During this conversation, I stated twice to Hammond, quote, you're trading me because I am pregnant, end quote. Hammond responded, quote, what do you want me to do? Hamby has also claimed, this is a pretty shocking one, that the reason that she's also claiming that the Aces attempted to obtain her private OBGYN medical records after she was no longer a member of their organization. So there's a lot there. Hammond was suspended because the coach was suspended for apparently saying something very ugly and inappropriate to Hamby. I haven't seen anywhere what the actual comment is, nor am I sure that, like, we need to know exactly what it is. The implication seems to be that it was something very ugly, alluding to the fact that Hamby had somehow been unprofessional or failed the team by getting pregnant. Lindsay talks about this a little bit in the interview, but I just wanted to let you know that's the background on the De'Erica Hamby story, the discrimination lawsuit. So when you hear us talking about what Becky is alleged to have said, nobody knows what Becky Hammond is specifically alleged to have said, but we know that she was suspended for it. And we know that this is a league, the WNBA, that in the past has suspended a coach for a game for making, it was about Liz Cambage. There was a coach who made what were considered inappropriate comments that body shamed a player for her weight. And that coach was suspended for a game as a result of that offense. So for Hammond to be suspended for two games, that lets you know that's not cool. Kurt Miller was the coach of the Sun, the Connecticut Sun, who in 2021 was fined $10,000 and suspended for a body shaming comment about Liz Cambage. That man, Kurt Miller, now is the coach of the Sparks, the team that Hamby plays for. So just giving you the background on all of that before the Lindsay interview begins, which will happen now in a few seconds. As always, everyone, thank you very much for being with us. Please follow along. You know, I usually open with follow us on Twitter, but like that's just a fast sinking ship. So follow us on our Patreon, patreon.com/Jacobin Sports Show. If you do not currently subscribe, please do. If you want to email jacobinsports@gmail.com, you can follow today's guest, Lindsay D'Arcangelo, on Twitter if you would like. It's at darkangel21, D-A-R-C, and then the word angel21. So that is it for this part. Please enjoy the interview now with Lindsay D'Arcangelo, and I will talk to you all again soon. Peace, everybody. I would like to now welcome to the show our special guest for this week. Our guest has been covering the WNBA for The Athletic. They are also the first three-time guest in the history of the Jacobin Sports Show, which I looked it up legally. You are now the majority shareholder in the company. So congratulations. Welcome to you. Glad to have you back on the pod, Lindsay D'Arcangelo. How are you doing?
I'm great. That's awesome news. I'm very proud.
Well, we need you because this is literally the second week in a row that I just realized while I was doing an intro before the guest came on that my microphone was muted the entire time, which is also why when you just came on and I tried to introduce you, it was also silent. So I'm getting a little old, so I'm going to try to wrap this pod up as quickly as we can today. Lindsay, I want to talk to you about some WNBA finals questions. We'll talk a little bit about the recent news with expansion. And also, I want to just get a quick maybe primer from you on the De'Erica Hamby situation, because I think you can probably help our listeners and myself with some of what's going on there. But first, we'll start with the finals, where game one went to the Las Vegas Aces, 99-82. It was a close game at the half. And then after the half, the champions basically championed. They outscored the Liberty by 20 points after the break. Stanley Brondello talked after the game. In part, she felt that the Aces were finding a bit of an edge against the Liberty switching defense. And also, you could see if you watched the game that the Liberty, who usually for all of their talent tried to move the ball around a lot, were settling a lot of times for the first shots that they could get instead of moving the ball to get shots that they wanted. The Aces' three-guard lineup exploded for 72 points. Jackie Young and Chelsea Gray and Kelsey Plum basically all went off in the game. Asia Wilson had a 19. Lindsay, what did you see, if anything, in that game? Did you see something that you felt like the Aces figured it out or the Liberty need to turn it around? What stood out to you the most from the outcome in game one?
Yeah, so, well, first off, the first half obviously was way more competitive, and I made the mistake of tweeting about that because we've been waiting for that type of game because, yeah, you know, in as much as these teams have already played each other, we have yet to see that real game come down to the wire type game, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think as much as they've played each other, that they would have figured each other out a little bit better by this point. So there's some things missing. And my first thought is the guard play. I mean, the Aces guards, and I said this before the finals, before on a different podcast, or maybe even possibly in my 12 questions column, mentioned it as well. But the guards for the Aces are just so much more quicker. They have better athleticism, and they're better on defense than the Liberty's guards. And I'm not just talking about the backcourts. I mean, just comparatively at the guard position, the Aces have the edge in that regard. And they showed it in this game. I mean, it was on full display. I think, what was it, Jackie Young, Kelsey Plum, and Chelsea Gray all had over 20 points?
Yeah, they did.
I mean, that's just, how do you deal with that on both ends of the floor, not just on the offensive end, but also defensively? And then for whatever reason, we have yet to see that Breanna Stewart type, Stewie type game that we know she's capable of having in these playoffs. And the Liberty need her to have one of those games. She's still effective, you know, she's still put up over 20 points, but it's not that, you know, dominant game that we're so used to seeing her have. And a lot of that, I'm not talking about the previous series, but in this series, in the finals, a lot of that has to do with what the Aces are doing defensively. So those were my first initial two thoughts after watching this game.
I love the point about the guard play. I think the Liberty have had such a – because the Liberty, I think, have had such a just spectacular season by their franchise standards. It's really been a lot of just – if you're a Liberty fan, it's really been nothing, but you're just grateful. It's been like such a great season that there hasn't been a lot to call out, particularly after the All-Star break. But one thing that has been noticeable, even in the opening two rounds against – Washington with their guards, Natasha Cloud and Sykes, and then especially even when Connecticut, as a change of pace, brought in Carrington, the Liberty don't have just a blazing guard. They have like really great guards. Courtney Vandersloot is a Hall of Famer. Ionescu is an All-Star. Rein Johannes might be the most beloved person on the planet, but they don't have just that. That is one thing that's missing that Vegas has been able to definitely have in spades in their backcourt. Are you seeing with Stewart anything? It's hard to look at an MVP in a sample size and say like, okay, like they're off. But like, are you seeing something that where Stewart is looking different than the regular season, or is it just shots not falling, or what?
I mean, she shot almost 50% from the floor. Not so great from the 3-point line. She's been, I think, from the perimeter, her shot's been, you know, a little bit inconsistent, but it's really, I think, just making it tough for her, like not giving her the easy looks, the easy buckets.
Yeah.
I think we saw the Sun do that to her with Alyssa Thomas guarding her, just really bodying her, being physical. And we saw her get visibly frustrated. And I think that's this kind of same approach that the Aces have taken to be more physical, to force her into tough shots. And because she's a rhythm player. I mean, a lot of great shooters are. It's getting into rhythm. You can keep a player from getting, you know, out of that rhythm and making it tough for them. It's hard for them to really establish themselves. And, you know, we may see New York try to get her some of those easy buckets just to help get her into a rhythm next game. But yeah, that's what I saw.
Do you think that, so the Liberty have been pretty adamant, Sandy Martell has been pretty adamant all season that the Liberty are at their best, despite the diversity of star power in when they're moving the ball and when they're staying balanced. But one thing that's been kind of noticeable in this postseason stretch, Stewart has, like you said, particularly mostly struggled from deep. Ionescu, outside of a couple of explosive performances, her numbers are down, particularly from deep. She's down in the regular season from about 44% from three till about 33-34. Courtney Vandersloot's shooting is also down a bit. And meanwhile, Jonquel Jones, every single game, seems to put up a double-double and just cause mayhem in the paint. Nobody seems to be able to, you know, the Sun had DeWanna Bonner, who's like 75 pounds less than her. It seems like you have this cheat code. Here's Jonquel. And not only is this a former all-star who we know can score, we know can command attention, but potentially drawing that attention down low, maybe that would open up things on the perimeter. But the Liberty all season have not been a team that just force feeds one star to get others going. Do you think that, like, you could see game one and say, all right, we have to change something? Or you could see game one and say, like, you know what, our formula, even against the Aces, has been pretty successful this season. Let's stick with what we've gone. Did you get any sense watching the game that the Liberty need to lean more towards, okay, this is the finals, like, you got to make changes now? Or do you feel like it's more they have to get to who they are, whatever that entails?
Well, you make a great point, because one of the things I wrote about the Liberty this year, it being their biggest asset, is their ball movement, their assists. I didn't look at it recently, so I don't know if they still lead the league in assists. I know they were up there in total assists, but that was a big part of their game, their ball movement. They're making the extra pass, you know, like you said, they were doing the other night with settling for, you know, the first shot, maybe the second shot. Like, when they're rolling, they're getting that ball around, you know, they're whipping it around the perimeter. They're getting it inside. They're getting it back out. They're making that extra pass. They're finding the open man. So that being their biggest asset, when they're not doing that, and I think part of that is the Aces' defensive approach. So every game you're going to make adjustments, right? You know, there's going to be some minor tweaks here and there, but I think you're right. I think they don't need to like get away from what they do well. I think they need to find a way to get that out, to rely on that, to do that more. As far as Jonquel Jones goes, she's been consistent, you know, double doubles, like you said, pounding on the glass. They need her to keep doing that. Lainey is, so many people have talked about her being an X factor, and myself included. And, you know, I think when she has less than 15, that's not good for the Liberty.
Yeah.
She's great defensively, but they also need her offensive production, to be on point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think they just need to get back to like who they are, like you said.
Certainly the league and its TV partners would love for them to get back to who they are, because you can tell that they're hoping for as long a series as possible. What's interesting, you mentioned earlier, and it has been a bizarre kind of twist to this rivalry. 5 of the 6 meetings this year have been decided by 9 or more points, which doesn't seem like what you want for the, you know, the league's foundational appointment viewing, but it really hasn't hurt ratings any. And in fact, in game one, this series drew a record 729,000 viewers, which is the most for game one of any finals in 23 years, going back to when the Liberty and Houston Comets were meeting for the third time in 4 years. That number is the game one viewership this season is a 20% increase over the previous high, which was set in 2016 between the Sparks and the Minnesota Lynx. Is this just like just perfection for the league? Like, not only do you have these two teams who have, you know, you see in a lot of sports, like putting together a super team that doesn't often result in ultimate success. It certainly doesn't result in immediate success. You always see a story of like the team that seemed to win the offseason and it backfired for some reason. And yet here the NBA has these two teams WNBA has these two teams in these two marquee cities. They both had these exceptional regular seasons. They're here in the finals. Even when the games are not instant classics, the people are coming. There's no question, but this is just very exciting as a fan of the sport, just seeing like it's come together, opportunity and passion and investment by people. And it's just wonderful. It's very nice at this stage and at this point in the league's history to see this. There's not a question mark there. I just think it's really, really cool. And I wonder how you feel as someone who covers it, but also enjoys it.
Yeah. I mean, seeing the increase in numbers year over year, and I think especially last year and this season, they've just been even that much. There's more of a way more of an increase than in previous years. It's been encouraging. It's been kind of like, not I told you so, but those of us who've been covering this league for a while have been banging our heads against the wall saying, you got to put the games on TV where people can find them. That will increase your viewership, your fan base, because people were often like, oh, it's the chicken or the egg comment. You know, do you put the games on TV and then the fans come, or do you get the fans and then put the games on TV? It's not a chicken and an egg conversation. It absolutely is not. You put the games, you make them accessible. You provide this link between people who are watching and the athletes, of connection, of knowing who they are, of putting a name with a face, and you create more fans. You draw in the casual fan. It's just it's not brain surgery. So they're doing that, and we're seeing the results of that. And you know, you mentioned the numbers and from Sunday, that was even up against NFL games. Yeah. So there is so much to be encouraged by there. Just the fact that the league is continuing to grow, that viewership is continuing to grow, even up against, you know, the powerhouse that is the NFL. It's not only encouraging and rewarding, it's let's keep it going. We told you there's investment opportunities here. There's just room for so much more growth. You know, women's sports, people are keep saying, are having a moment. No, they're not having a moment. This is what's happening. It's not a moment that's just going to pass. It's going to keep going in this direction. And those of us who have seen this happening and this trajectory happening for a while are saying, see?
And especially, I thought what was a really striking moment to experience as a fan, like, I took a while away from the league when Liberty kind of, you know, they were down for a few years. But when the league started, you know, and the Liberty were playing the comments, and I remember when Teresa Weatherspoon hit the three against Houston, like I went crazy in my friend's living room. Like I have followed the league in a sense from the start, and seen on a Sunday, like you said, when there's a million football games going on, and my Twitter is exploding because a guard who comes off the bench for the Liberty hit a one-legged three-pointer that had like the entire sports world, not WNBA world, not basketball world, but like everybody talking about that shot and seeing it retweeted everywhere and seeing it celebrated everywhere. The fact that it wasn't even, that shows not just that the league is succeeding and that it's growing and expanding, but that whereas a lot of other sports, you know, there's this constant pursuit of like the casual fan, but these are people like these, this is showing a level of commitment and interest and engagement that's not a casual level. Like when you have the general public of your sport talking about a shot from a player who's not even, if you follow the game, you know Marine Johannes, but she's not someone a casual is just going to necessarily know. And that was an epicenter event. That's a significant happening just on a cultural level. Like this is what everyone is talking about. And like you're saying, it's not transitory. It's not like, oh, what a funny exception. It's like, no, like everything else, like just put it there and the people will show you, yeah, we want this. Like we love this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the athletes themselves, the games, the moments within the games, the results of the games, the back and forth debate. You know, it's all a point of conversation. And this is where we've wanted women's sports to be. This is where they are, and this is where it's going to keep going.
Speaking of where it's going, the WNBA announced that it is expanding to two teams. Now, I want to make sure I'm clear on this. I know that the Bay Area thing is official. Has Portland officially gotten the set? No, still not yet. What is the holdup there?
They've, from what I've read and from what I know from talking to people who know more than me about the situation, is they've reached the level of the board of governors where there's, you know, there's different levels of moving along in the process. And so they're being strongly considered, but is it officially official? No. And I believe that there are reports out there that maybe read like they were officially official, but you know, that's not the case. It'll be interesting because there was a lot of, you know, breaking news on that. And should they not be, you know, should it not get final, a deal get finalized, then those people are going to have to walk it back a little bit. I know some, I have friends in this industry who do break news, and they were like, listen, I wasn't going to say anything about this because, you know, you don't want to get this wrong. And then because so many things could change, you know, within however long this process is going to take. So not, you're right. The Bay Area is officially official. But the second team, and we know there's going to be a second team because you can't, first of all, have 13 teams. Right. And the WNBA said there would be another one. So we have yet to know who that is for sure.
So after the Bay Area news, you tweeted something about the significance not only of the WNBA expanding, but specifically expanding to franchises with owners with deeper pockets. Can you elaborate a little bit on why it's not just about we're adding some teams here, but the significance of adding a team that's going to be owned by the Lakers in the Bay Area?
Well, I think players around the league see what's happening, obviously, in New York and in Vegas and in with teams that have money. Phoenix is getting a whole new practice facility now with their new owner. You want to play for teams like that. You want to go where maybe you can get a little extra amenities, where you know, coaches are going to want to go where they can be paid what they feel they're worth, as Becky Hammon proved. You know, it's a good thing, I think, for players, and I think it's a good thing for the league because it's going to raise the bar. And some of the teams with multiple owners, or maybe not the kind of ownership that can afford to do certain things, are going to have to level up and find a way to level up. So it's just, like I said, it's going to raise the bar, and it's those teams are going to be attracting, you know, the big time free agents when free agency rolls around. And though, because that's where you want to play. If you're a star player, you want to be treated like a star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you know, if you're listening and you're not like totally familiar with some of the WNBA realities, like Vegas has like a complete state of the art, like practice Valhalla, that a lot of teams don't have something on that level. The Liberty are very invested in support staff and all kinds of coaching. The Liberty owner Josai was fined at one point for flying his players charter, or at least for wanting to, or for doing it. So some franchises operate, you know, a bit differently than others. Has there been any, have you heard anything about whether the league would either move teams from west to east to accommodate the newcomers, or if they would abolish conferences altogether to have, because to have balance, if they're going to add to, especially if it's the Bay Area and let's say theoretically Portland, you would think then that two other teams would have to move to the east.
Well, I mean, if you look at the map, you know, I think something would have to be restructured with, say, like Minnesota or something. Maybe they become like those teams in the middle.
Yeah, maybe Dallas.
Because the East Coast has plenty of teams right now. And I do think adding West Coast, you know, it was necessary.
Yeah.
As I'm picturing it in my head, you know. But, I mean, how, you know, conferences really aren't relative now. I mean, how does it matter right now? It's for the Eastern Conference Player of the Week, the Western Conference Player. I mean, really, when you shake it down, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect the playoffs. Like,
my heart's desire is that all sports will just stop pretending. Some sports can stop pretending that conferences matter, and I feel like this is one. Like, you don't even need to have conferences, given the way the playoff seeding goes. You're right. I don't understand sometimes why they hold on to conferences when they don't affect seeding, when they don't really, you know, impact. It's not like it's the 50s and you're taking a train everywhere. I don't know.
I mean, that's the way it's always been done. And it's very hard to like move away from the way things have always been done. And in the NFL, it matters. You know, it impacts the playoffs. It literally is how the playoffs shake out with the conferences and the seeding. You have to win you have to win your conference in order, you know, it's just, it's all part of the process. But in the WNBA, you don't have to win your conference to, you just have to win to make the playoffs. You have to win enough games and get at least that eighth playoff spot, and then you're in. And then it sort of all shakes out from that. So aside from the during the season awards that they give out, as far as weekly conference players of the week and stuff like that, other than that, it does not matter. And you could easily change that. You could just pick two of the best players of the week, one and two.
I'm liking that worldview. I would much prefer to see that. Has there been anything said about so right now the league has 12 teams, and whenever teams are added, there are expansion fees. So, you know, the league literally profits just from the initial addition of these franchises. The league has said that they will not have all the teams travel. They will not have any teams fly charter until all the teams can afford to fly charter. Is there any awareness that now that they've added two new teams and there's expansion fees and all that stuff, if now is going to be the time where that can happen, or has there been no talk of that yet?
Not that I'm aware of. I have not heard any talk of the travel. I mean, you have to believe it's coming into play. And yeah, it's going to be a key talking point in the next CBA negotiations. We already know that. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure changes will be made coming down the road.
Okay. Let me ask you one last question to take it back to the Aces and an off-the-court story. Which it was a player named Erica Hamby. Hamby is a two-time All-Star prior with Vegas. She's currently filed a discrimination lawsuit against the Aces and the WNBA. There's a lot of background in the story. There's a two-game suspension of Vegas coach Becky Hammon. The Aces were docked a first-round draft pick over, questions of illegality in the negotiations. Can you explain what the contention is here between the player, the team, and the league, and what is being, what actually is being accused of happening?
Discriminatory practices would be the main issue, I believe. It's not a story that I've investigated or have covered in depth, so I can't give you like the full rundown of you know, the key points to it. What we do know is kind of what you said, and just the way it was handled. I mean, obviously, De'Erica feels she has a case. She has plenty of evidence and reason to bring this to our awareness. You know, what's funny to me, and I'm just gonna say this from like just a reaction standpoint of all this, because it's something we should be talking more about. It's something that I feel like is just getting cast aside here because we're in the midst of the WNBA finals and the Aces are so good and we all love Becky Hammon. But some of the things that Hamby is accusing the Aces as well as Becky Hammon of are pretty yucky. You know what I mean?
There's talk of that potentially the team accessed her medical files without her consent. I know that part of the claim, and I don't know this, I don't know how this legality works at all, but I know that there's some talk about whether the player wasn't open about being pregnant when they were negotiating for a contract. And I didn't even know our teams, I don't know how this works legally. It wouldn't seem to me that a team, like, on the one hand, obviously, if a player is pregnant, that is going to impact, you know, their ability to play for you that season or something. But it would seem to me like the root of illegality to be able to discriminate against someone because they're pregnant or might become pregnant. So,
yeah,
that seems like a huge story.
Agreed. And I think even the language in the CBA maybe it needs to be updated or whatnot regarding, but there needs to be a larger conversation. It was like, what was she supposed to do? Just not get pregnant? Like, I'm going to promise you I'm not going to get, like, sometimes we all know how it happens. Sometimes it just happens. And there's no way that she should be held accountable for doing something that as a woman, you know, you are perfectly allowed to do at your own discretion, like regardless of your career or, you know, whether it be an athlete or not. If this was, you know, a 9-to-5 corporate job and she was being fired because she got pregnant, that would be a huge story. Yeah. So I don't like the fact that this is not, that it's not being talked about, at least in the WNBA circle and in social media. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not having